Hello and welcome to episode 39 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, Breaking Orbit Part 2. At the end of the last episode, we reached the end of Milan Miljanic's domestic career, and now it's time to see what he was doing in his final season in Crvena Zvezda and beyond. Because while the proceedings of our last episode were going on domestically, Yugoslavia were in the midst of trying to get to the 1974 World Cup, initially under Vujadin Boskov. After their jaunt to Brazil for the Independence Cup, the team resumed European football with a friendly defeat to Italy before drawing with England at Wembley, which would see the debut of the BMV at international level, Velezes, Bajovic, Maric and Vladic, and their club form carried on to the larger stage, with Franjo Vladic scoring on debut against England, and then Bajovic scoring a double in the first World Cup qualifier, a 2-2 draw away to Spain. 1972 would end with a win over Greece at the Maracanã before things started to go awry. Boskov would have only one more competitive game in charge, but what happened in 1973 was enough for the FA to turn sour on him. A series of draws and friendlies against Poland and Hungary, and following it up with a draw against Spain at the Maracanã, was enough to convince them that for the 1974 World Cup to be reached, Boskov, never the most popular person within higher circles at the FA, had to go. The result was that in October 1973, Milan Miljanic would return as national team manager, heading up a managerial committee of him, Sula Rebac, Tomislav Ivic, Zvezdnikov's title-winning manager Milan Rybar, and a man who would soon be in charge at Crvena Zvezda, Milovan Sirić, who is the only one of the five not pulling double duty at this time. Whatever the logic behind that confusing star chamber of managerial excellence, it worked. Greece were defeated in Athens, which, as the sides were level on points and goal difference, meant a playoff against Spain would have to be held in Frankfurt in February. Josip Katalinski scored early to become the hero who sent the nation back to West Germany later that year. The win was perhaps not the most accurate reflection of Yugoslav form, given it was followed by friendly losses to the USSR and Hungary, before a 2-2 draw against England at the Maracanã, England who hadn't qualified, and the game itself featured perhaps the greatest goal ever scored for the nation by Brane Oblak, which, if you're going down a little YouTube rabbit hole, is very well worth your time finding and watching. When it came to the World Cup itself, it became a mix of taking upon the sublime and the ridiculous, but with plenty of new talent. For the first time, Yugoslavia would take Slovenes to a major tournament, with the inclusion of Branko Oblak and Danilo Popovoda. At just 18, Crvena Zvezda's newest young star, Vladimir Petrovic, would go as well. Petrovic himself isn't a player we've mentioned much yet, but he broke into the Zvezda side at just 16 and played almost every game for the club for the two seasons prior, and will, from this point, go on to some very great things. With 8 Zvezda players and 7 Hajduk players, it was easy to see the direction of Yugoslav football, with the other major contingents being the BMV from Velez, and both Josip Katalinski and Enver Hadzijabic from Zvezdnikov, transplanting the heart of Zelio's defence into the squad. Yugoslavia, however, were not massively fancied at the tournament, and much of that comes from the group they were put in. The seeded team in their group were holders Brazil, who were not the vintage of 1970, but had beaten Yugoslavia at the Independence Cup, and were still hardly a bad side. The pots, after the seeding, had then been split geographically, and while Yugoslavia avoided the real bogey of the European pot, the Dutch, the side they did get, Scotland, were hardly a bad side, given that they comprised of the spine of Leeds United with the cream of Celtic and Rangers. Jardine, McGrane, Bremner, Johnston, Dalglish, Jordan, Hay, Lorimer. It was a phenomenally talented lineup, and one with more about it than the side who would go to Argentina 4 years later, crying loudly that they were going to win the World Cup. The other team in the group would be Zaire, managed by former Radnički Belgrade goalkeeper and Olympic gold medalist Blagoje Vidinic. And Zaire would play a great part in deciding the destination of the group, courtesy of being rather terrible. The World Cup began with Yugoslavia versus Brazil, and at the same stadium where Yugoslavia ousted Spain in the playoff. And like many games against Brazil, Yugoslavia were first to put in a backs against the wall performance. Brazil were well on top in the first half, but save for a Jairzinho shot poked wide when through, their threat was more or less all from distance. In the second half, Ilija Petković spooned over a big chance from a Zajac cross, then Sujak shot straight at the keeper when fouled in the box by Oblak. Oblak himself would then hit the post with a near post header from a corner. A point was considered enough for Yugoslavia, in what was a promising performance that nullified Brazil's threat from open play for the full 90 minutes and perhaps should have seen a win for Miljanic's men as they grew progressively through the game. There were 5 days between that and match two of the World Cup for Yugoslavia, a game that would go down in history, be it famously or infamously. For one, it remains tied as the largest margin of victory at a World Cup tournament. Nor has any game had as many individual goal scorers in a World Cup as this. One Zaire player, Ndiaye Mulamba, would end up with a year banned for booting the referee in the backside, in spite of it actually being a case of mistaken identity and the actual culprit, Mwepu Ilunga, being the man who, in their final group match, sprinted out of the wall and punted the ball downfield to stop Brazil taking a free kick. Had only the referee known that black people don't all look the same, then that famous moment in the Brazil game would never have happened. Some context, however, is needed before we get into the Yugoslavia result. For one, the Zaire players were overdue bonuses that hadn't turned up when expected to, in large part due to an inflated band of diplomatic hangers-on who spent the money that the players were entitled to. FIFA themselves had to reach into their pocket to bail out the team, to pay players not to strike. Secondly, manager Blagoje Vidinic was relieved of certain duties. The team talk itself was given by one of the nation's president's staff, as they believed that Vidinic had given their game plan away to the Yugoslav side, which he obviously hadn't. So while Zaire had performed well in an opening 2-0 defeat to Scotland, impressing with their intensity and commitment to attack, between the two games, the proverbial had hit the fan. The subsequent shellacking was inevitable. Yugoslavia were 3-0 up within 20 minutes, so Vidinic subbed the keeper, replacing him with a 5-foot-4-inch player who then conceded 6 more before the game was out. Bajevic had a hat-trick, with goals also going the way of Zajac, Sujak, Katalinski, Bogacevic, Oblak and Petković. And while a couple of the goals came from free kicks and little could be done, the rest were simply Yugoslavia ripping a side that were mentally spent to shreds. And in the Scottish camp, that rang huge alarm bells. Because at the same time as Yugoslavia was setting African football back a decade or two, Scotland did just what Yugoslavia did against Brazil. Neuter the Samba superstars, but not get a win. And with that, the realisation that just beating Zaire by 2 goals probably wouldn't be enough to get the best of the maths on goal difference. If Scotland were to stay in the World Cup, only victory in the last game against Yugoslavia were to do it. Obviously, given that staying in the World Cup was on the line, Scotland failed. It would not be unfair to describe the game as one of the most angst over in the history of the Scottish national team. Undefeated at the World Cup, yet out on their backsides all the same. It looked like it could have been much different for a large portion of the game. So the Scots repeatedly tested Enver Maric in the defence, but in the 81st minute, a steepling header from Kourassi would kill any Scottish hopes, with the only goal that the Scots would concede all tournament. Joe Jordan would score 7 minutes later to give Scottish hopes brief light, but it was of little import. Scotland created nothing after that, stifled by the organisation of Miljanic's side. Brazil defeated Zaire by the far more respectable score of 3-0, and Scotland were out. Yugoslavia topped the group on goal difference. 1974 would see a second group stage in effect at the World Cup, with the winners of each second group meeting in the final and the second place sides going into the third place playoff. Yugoslavia opened up that group against hosts West Germany. On 39 minutes, Paul Breitner opened the scoring with a shot from distance that clipped off a challenge in front of him and hurtled straight into the top corner. Gerd Müller finished it off in the last 10 minutes as Germany took advantage of a quick free kick Müller poked home from close range. It was a fair result. The Germans had famously had a stuttering first group, but outplayed Yugoslavia here from the off. Second up would be Poland, and Yugoslavia would fall, at first, to sheer idiocy. Defending a free kick, Yugoslavia would clear their lines, but a flashpoint came in Karasi, doing some man marking, kicked out and got caught. Kazimierz Zdena ensured his petulance was punished from the spot. Karasi would redeem himself 20 minutes later, picking up a through ball and rounding the keeper to equalise, but that was where the good news ended. Lato would head in a corner just after the hour, and the Poles would have the win. So while Poland and Germany were both through, sort of, and were playing what was a World Cup semi-final in all but name, Yugoslavia were left to play Sweden for pride and nothing more. Yugoslavia would take the lead. Jajic surging past the Swedish defence on the counter before a perfect cross allowed Suryak to tap in at the far post. But that lead would last only 2 minutes. Sweden went up from kickoff, earned a corner, and as Maric fumbled his catch to the waiting Edström, Torstensson would benefit from a knockdown and slack defending late to win it. Yugoslavia had cleared the first group well, but at the second hurdle, they'd fallen flat on their faces. They'd shown themselves to be competitive, but not serious challengers. And the charge of negative tactics had been laid at their door. Take away the Zaire result, and Yugoslavia had scored only 3 times in 5 games, and that particular allegation wouldn't shift. The coaching committee of Yugoslavia ended there. Come the next game at home to Italy in September, the side would be run by the former national youth coach Biše Mladinić. Miljanić will come again to the national side, but his immediate concern was far away. 2 days after Yugoslavia's World Cup ended, Miljanic's new adventure began, becoming coach of Real Madrid. Quite aside from every accolade that Miljanic won during his career, and there are plenty, being manager of Real is what he became most known for on a wider stage. He wouldn't even be Real's only Yugoslav manager. Vujadin Boškov and Radi Antic would follow. But Miljanic would be an important manager in shifting Real from the legend of their glory days into the modern era. As odd as it may seem to modernise where the club are permanently ensconced, either at the top of the Spanish game or second in the Spanish game, Real Madrid in 1974 was somewhat in the doldrums. The 14-year spell of Miguel Muñoz had come to an end with the club not having won a trophy for 2 years, and only having won one trophy in the decade to date full stop. The season before Miljanic joined, they were an almost unthinkable eighth, although had at least collected the Copa del Rey. Only 4 times in their history had the club finished with a lower league position. When it came to the squad, it was ageing, and as if to exemplify it, in the previous Clásico, they had been outclassed 5-0 by Barcelona. Miljanic's cure was relatively simple. He brought along his fitness coach from Sfina Zvezda, and he trained, upping sessions to 3 a day, running through the day and into the night. Detailed tactical sessions were brought in, with players soaking up knowledge, one of which would be a certain Señor Vicente del Bosque. The result was that those older players who had been so easily swept aside, getting a new lease of life. There were tactical changes like making midfielder Pirri a sweeper and moving Paul Breitner forwards that gave the side more solidity and more ability to go back to front quickly. The impact was immediate. Real Madrid won the double. But there would be controversy in that first season too. For one, Miljanic was criticised for negative play. The accusation itself fit, if not because of results, then at least because Miljanic's work was on making the side better prepared and better organised. And in addition to playing the possession play at Stena Zvezda, making him capable of swift transitions that he may have picked up having watched Liverpool. Those howls of derision would get much louder in his second season. The second piece of controversy would be in Europe, as come the quarterfinals of the Cup Winners' Cup, Milan Miljanic's Real Madrid met another domestic behemoth from across the continent. Stena Zvezda. Miljanic would not travel to Belgrade for the second leg, stating, "I cannot betray my heart." Real would blow a lead and be eliminated on penalties at the Maracanã. Across the past two episodes, Milan Miljanic would define the 70s. In Yugoslavia, he took Stena Zvezda as far as he could and, in the process, accidentally created a Scouse juggernaut that would sweep all before them. For the national side, he embedded a way of playing that would arguably be with us until the end of Yugoslavia itself and would, perhaps less arguably, be to the great long-term detriment of Yugoslav football as a whole. In Spain, he represented not just the move of Real Madrid to modernity, but the move of Spain itself. A tale stands of Miljanic visiting none other than General Franco himself on the deathbed. Those long-term listeners will know that Franco and Yugoslavia had no love lost. He had screwed them in the 50s and 60s by ensuring that the image of a Yugoslav side victorious on fascist Spanish soil would, for ideological reasons, never be allowed to come to pass. Yet on his deathbed, Franco told Miljanic that he had never had such a strong and honest man at Real Madrid as Miljanic. Franco wouldn't live to see Miljanic collect his second La Liga title with the club. For Spain, for now, the old guard was passing away. Next time on the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, we go back to Yugoslavia, as while Miljanic was excelling in Spain, a new man rose to become the face of the first league from the dugout. And one way or another, he simply had to be stopped. We'll be taking a little break in terms of main timeline releases over the next few weeks, quite simply because I'm in the middle of moving house. And one thing that is quite important to doing the research behind putting together this podcast is having internet resources. And as anyone who moves house will know, your time and connectivity becomes seriously, seriously compromised for a short period of time. I do have profile podcasts backed up, so we'll make sure that there is something coming out on your podcast subscription feeds over the coming weeks. But it may be slightly less than normal, and it may be more like September that we're back to the timeline as normal. But obviously, I promise we will get there. I promise there will be content nonetheless, even if it's somewhat ad hoc on current events potentially. So, for now, from here, I'll catch you next time.